Chapter 29, Tour of Duty. Try the road and see the woods, and feel the wind at sea. Just pack up all your worldly goods and come along with me. We'll see their sights and eat their food, and tarry with their lasses. If their lads break up our mood, we'll kick their scrawny asses. Whene'er we stop, which shan't be soon, with no place left to roam, we'll pack up for the next day's noon, and set off back for home. They sang as they rode, the mood lighter than it had been upon their departure. When traded stories began to wear thin, the mood of the travelers had grown solemn. Brennus had a lot churning in his thoughts, and he had grown prone to long periods of introspection. Lost in thought as the others carried on quiet discussions around him, careful not to disturb him. The effects of the tattoo Kairos had inscribed on his shoulder made Brennus nervous. It had seemed like such a clever idea when he had conceived of it, taking a cultural difference between the worlds and combining two arts into a formidable defense. Kairos seemed no worse for the ward he bore 2 days later, but how long would that be the case? He had made casual inquiries about the use of wards for protecting their persons and the troops, on the pretense of finding innovative ways to combat the goblins' expected attack. None of the four sorcerers had thought it a prudent idea. Iridan worked with wards regularly and thought that it would be unhealthy, though it might work temporarily. Ruglor thought that simply writing on the skin would not hold up to the rigors of sweat and rubbing cloth, and the rune would be ruined before it provided any real benefit. Brennus could not convey the idea of a tattoo without having to get into more detail than he thought appropriate. He let the matter drop, not satisfied at all with what he had heard. Brennus knew that it was dangerous to go into battle with troops whose morale was poor, but these were not troops in the conventional sense. When conscripts and knights often jested and sang on their way to battle, it felt different. The conscripts, especially if they were completely green, as many were easily deluded into the gloried notions of battle that the troubadours peddled. Knights? Well, knights were hard to deter. They knew the sins of blood and flesh they were about to face, and faced it anyway. The brotherhood of the knighthood was what they leaned on to get them through. With Iridan, Ruglor, Phelan, and Juliana, he was traveling with educated, cultured, and, except for Iridan, untested neophytes. Wars were pages in history books, celebrated with parades. They knew they would see things they had never wished to see, and would fear for their lives, and Brennus could not just sing a trail song to get them to forget that. It was Juliana, of all people, who had broken the mood by breaking into song. She had an impressive repertoire of trail and tavern songs, many of them bawdy enough to make him blush, though only because the tawdriness of the lyrics was accentuated when a young lady sang them. She did not, however, have the voice for them. She could keep time well enough, but the notes held little melody after she was done wringing the tune out of them. "I apologize for the ones with overly strained meter and poor rhymes," Juliana said. "I learned them from the traders that frequent the city, and translated many of them into Kadrin myself. Much of Kadrus is boring, and the songs our bards write are the same. Things are much more entertaining down by the wharfs, where you find all manner of exotic foreigners." Brennus suspected that young sorceresses of the Sixth Circle needed to be kept busier if she had so much time to spend hanging around dockside barrooms, where she said she learned most of the songs she knew. The songs sounded vaguely familiar, at least as best as Juliana could render them, but Brennus knew the words to only a few. "I used to wonder what you did with your free time," Brennus joked. "I guess now I know."
"Brennus, that is no way to talk about a lady," Iridan jumped in, indignantly defending a perceived slight to his betrothed's honor.
"Well, I had meant the translations," Brennus clarified, and Iridan might have begun to blush if the cold air rushing by them had not already reddened his face. Onward they flew, for in truth, their horses had not touched the ground in hours, and the mountains engulfed them. They made their own passage as best they could, but their luck only held so long before they were forced to ascend. The sights all around them were magnificent as they worked their way up the steep grade of the mountainside. The horses,
trained as they were to obey without question, carried along as if they were on level ground and not mounting the vast craggy rocks of the cloud wall. Their ascent brought them up above the snow line, the point where it was winter every season and where the ice no longer melted before it took on snow again. As they crested the peak, a flat-topped caldera of an inactive volcano that was a tower's height deep in snow, they could see much of their day's ride ahead of them. There would be at least 3 more mountain crossings before they could reach the other side of the range, perhaps 4 if there was one obscured from view by larger mountains. Brannis resisted the urge to call a halt, unsure of what sort of footing was presently beneath them. So long as the horses kept in motion, they would continue to remain airborne just above whatever paltry ground lay below them. "Keep moving. Resist the temptation to stop and gawk," Brannis urged, as he took his own advice and allowed his mount to continue on down the far side of the mountain. The effect was both thrilling and terrifying. As they had ascended, it was easy to look forward and see the height of the peak shrink as they approached it. Now that he was heading down, Brannis could see the entire descent in its vast panoramic glory, spread out before and below him, with nothing to save him from a fatal plunge but the magic of the horseshoes his mount wore. With gravity to aid them and no footing to worry about, the horses sped ever faster as they went down. Brannis kept a light hold on the reins, hoping that the horse could react faster to obstacles in their path than he could, since the scenery was hurtling past at an awesome rate. Within moments, his horse had cleared the snow line and not long afterward reached the valley between mountains in less than a tenth the time they had taken to ascend. For 3 more mountains, they repeated the exercise, speeding down one mountain and carrying that momentum halfway up the next. The whole endeavor was upsetting to both the nerves and the stomach, and all but Juliana managed to lose some portion of their morning meal along the way. The sorceress seemed, however, to enjoy the ride. "Well, at least the goblins will be hampered by the weather," Brannis said, feeling cheerful. "And we seem to have reached the city before them." Indeed, there was no goblin host camped out in sight of the city, nor any sign of their imminent approach. Brannis's course had brought them out just north of the city. Winter had come early to the western face of the cloud wall, and they stood in ankle-deep snow beside their mounts, thankful to be near the end of their journey. Between them and the city lay Neverthaw Lake, through which the blue-green glacial waters of the Neverthaw River ran. The lake had once been a quarry during the early days of Rainstark's construction. With wards to keep them intact, the stone structures of the city had little need for additional stone, and the quarry eventually fell to disuse and was allowed to fill with water. Into the lake crashed Drexel Falls, named after the sorcerer who had diverted the Neverthaw's headwaters to fill the old quarry. It was a majestic sight, especially in winter when the falls partially froze. Though not yet winter, it was late enough into the autumn that Brannis and his companions were able to see the falls in the early phases of its icing over. The city of Rainsdark sat partway up the mountainside, tucked snugly in against the rock. Naught but stone could be seen of it. The outer walls, the defensive towers, and the tall buildings and castle keep beyond. All were built of the same dark stone once quarried just outside the city. Presumably in bygone ages, there were wooden structures, but Rainsdark was among the oldest cities in the Empire, and after long enough, folk tired of replacing buildings. Warded stone lasted like nothing else, and with the attentions of a ward keeper, could be maintained indefinitely. Brannis knew that while the city was largely hidden by the massive wall as they looked up at it, there was only so much above ground to be seen. Harsh weather had driven many of the inhabitants underground, where whole subterranean districts of the city lay. He had studied maps of the Overcity, the Undercity, and all of the mines, and the Overcity was the smallest part of the whole complex. What was above was mostly commerce and trade, barracks for Duke Peloton's garrison, and summer abodes for the wealthier of Rainsdark's citizenry. Duke Peloton's castle was a massive fortified structure that was built into the mountain itself, spanning the Overcity and Undercity, and offering entrance to the ancient and disused upper mines. The lower mines, the lifeblood of the city, were accessible elsewhere from the Undercity. The road approaching the city paralleled the river, just far enough away that it did not wash out in the spring floods. Upon reaching the base of the mountain, the wide tradeway meandered its way up to the city gates by way of a half dozen switchbacks, keeping the grade low enough for wagon teams to ascend safely. The setup also afforded the city's defenders an excellent vantage overlooking any approaching invaders, who would either have to take the long road or scale numerous smaller cliff faces to climb up directly. "Though we have made it in time for dinner, I find that I no longer hunger for it," Phelan remarked. He had taken the worst of it throughout the 5 days' journey, from saddle sores and leg cramps to aching back and nausea over the mountains. "There now, no need for gloom," Iridan said. "We have arrived, and our journey is finished. We can prevail upon Duke Peloton for proper accommodations tonight and recover from this ordeal." "Oh, yes," Juliana said. "I feel much better now that we have put ourselves in the path of a goblin army. I cannot be soon enough rid of these scary horses and slip into a nice relaxing battle for my life."
"Mind you, only Iridan and I are expected to join the battle," Brannis said. "The three of you are non-combatants once the fighting begins. You will stay with the peasant folk, helping with any evacuation as needed. Beforehand is when I will really need you. There will be much that needs doing, and we do not know how long we have. Hopefully, Duke Peloton will have scouts with a better idea of where the goblin army is. At the most, Illard's Glen is a 2-day march from here. It is mostly a matter of when they decide to strike."
"If you do not mind me asking, and mind you, this has played about my mind for days now, but how can you be certain they will strike here and not Corgan?" Rugler asked.
"You certainly waited long enough to ask that," Brannis said. "The simple answer? Goblins are not stupid. They have a force far too large to have been brought to conquer just Illard's Glen, and Corgan is no more of a threat, nor much more of a prize. The goblins attacked Illard's Glen to field test their new siege engine before bringing it to bear here at Rainsdark. They would not need a new wall-wrecking weapon if they were to attack Naran Port, which is the only other city in the region that would be a large enough target to justify bringing an army that size." Brannis tried to sound sure of his answer, but he knew there were several jumps of logic that could easily mislead them if any single one were wrong. Guessing the goblin's motive was the biggest risk in his plan.
"I would hate to hear the complex version," Phelan muttered just loud enough to be sure Brannis heard.
Brannis glared sidelong at the sorcerer but said nothing.
"Well, we are not yet in place to get ourselves attacked," Juliana said cheerfully. "We ought to get moving."
With that, she urged her horse to a gallop and shot off towards Rainsdark like a loosed arrow. Brannis took a quick glance at the other three sorcerers, shrugged, and took off after her. Iridan, Phelan, and Rugler followed in his wake. There had been no trouble at the city gates. Accompanied by the four sorcerers, one of whom was wearing warlock's garb, and bearing orders with the imperial seal, Brannis followed the gate guards directly to the castle to meet with Duke Peloton. The city had been on edge since the arrival of refugees from Illard's Glen several days earlier, bringing word of the goblin invasion. The walls teemed with soldiers in numbers that could not have been sustainable in peacetime. As they were escorted through the town to the castle, the streets stood deserted, eerily quiet, and curiously warm. Brannis had read that they used the heat from the smelters and forges of the Undercity to keep the roads and homes of the city above warm, preventing snowy roads and making the Overcity's homes livable in the depths of winter, in the heights of the cloud wall. Stone ducts ran in a maze between the two layers of the city, mixed in and around the Overcity's sewers, venting the immense heats generated below in the belly of the mountain. A low fog hung over much of the city as the moisture left by the snow gently steamed off, with nowhere cool to settle. The castle was no less imposing from up close than it had been from the other side of Neverthaw Lake. Colossal stone blocks formed its walls, each taller than a man, and fitted so closely together that no mortar was used in the entirety of the structure. It was impressive to look upon, but less so to Brannis,
who had studied the history of the place and knew that the stones had been reshaped by ether to fit so well. When a stable hand came to take their mounts to the subterranean portion of the city for safekeeping, Brennus looked down at him.
"Shoe them," Brennus said, "and have the old shoes set aside until our departure. The ones they are wearing right now have runes of speed upon them and could cause trouble in the stables if they get loose."
"Aye, your lordship,"
the lad responded with a nod. The stable hand then began helping the sorcerers out of their saddles. Iridan and Phelan had improved a bit over the past few days, but were still saddle-weary and aching in the hips, legs, and back. Rugler's back was bothering him from all the jostling, especially the last harrowing run of their ride. Juliana seemed to have fared as well as she had since the first day, stiff from long hours riding, but otherwise fine. Brannis had discovered to his pleasant surprise that the ruined armor he wore cushioned the worst of the horse's jarring gait, and he could easily have ridden all the rest of the day. Porters bearing the green and gold livery of House Peloton came and unpacked their belongings from the saddlebags and took their packs. The Duke's Chamberlain escorted them through the wide vaulted corridors of the castle to the drawing room, where Duke Peloton awaited them.
"So our warlock suspects the goblins will attack Rainsdark next, and this is what he sends,"
Duke Peloton asked by way of greeting as soon as they entered his presence. The Duke was standing when they arrived, aided by his cane, though it did not detract from his lean stature or erect posture. He wore his own green and gold version of a general's uniform, complete with tasseled epaulets of the sign of House Peloton, a mountain goat on a heater shield, where an imperial general would bear the emperor's golden hawk. His manicured goatee was shot through with streaks of black where it was not gray, and none would be the wiser if the hair on his head was likewise, for it was waxed bald. The Duke's expression was like the rest of him, stern, reserved, and unwelcoming.
"Indeed, Your Grace," Brennus said, skipping the formal introductions. "I suspect you would prefer to get this out of the way directly."
Brennus handed him the orders Roshan had sent with him, as the Duke seemed ill-inclined toward pleasantries. Two of the three men in the room with him bore striking resemblances to the Duke and seemed younger. It took little imagination to see that they were his sons. The third wore a loose black tunic trimmed in the Duke's colors, the sign of a house sorcerer. Brennus had only met a few sorcerers who had shunned the circle to take work in the employ of one of the noble houses. It was more common farther from the heart of the empire, as the influence of the circle waned and the nobles had more direct control of their local sorcerers. This specimen seemed to match his master's mood, a dour, scrawny man with a severe, finger-length black beard,
who was likely much older than the 30 winters he appeared to have seen.
Duke Peloton took the scroll case from Brennus's hand, and, leaning his cane against one of the large maroon-upholstered chairs, removed the document within and began reading. The other eight in the room waited and watched his expression as it ran the gamut from curiosity to surprise to puzzlement, then disbelief, anger, and resentment in succession. He handed Roshan's proclamation to the elder of his two sons.
"It seems the warlock has decided to commandeer my own troops. House Peloton has held Rainsdark against all foes since the earliest days of the empire, and this is the thanks we receive in return. I find the scant aid he saw fit to send to be more insulting than sending none at all. Now I see that on top of it, he is handing my army to this boy,"
Duke Peloton vented, gesturing to Brannis. Peloton's face was reddened, and his shoulders heaved slightly as he had run himself short of breath.
"I see that one in the warlock's cloak is Warlock Roshan's son. Caldrax, what do you think of the fire hurlers they sent us?"
the elder son asked House Peloton's sorcerer, handing the orders to his brother.
"Let me see," the sorcerer Caldrax said, his eyes losing focus. "I find nothing extraordinary, though the imitation warlock seems to have a respectable source. Nothing that I would consider to give us any significant tactical advantage should battle come to our walls. The girl is his arranged bride? How sweet. And completely unhelpful," the younger brother added as he reviewed the orders.
Is the whole family soured on the inside? The unadorned stone blocks of the castle seem more friendly than this lot, Brannis thought.
We are here, and you have all read the orders. I think a tour of the city is in order, and a review of the defenses, Brannis said, trying to remain above the Duke's personal dislike of Rashan's plan of how best to defend Rainsdark.
Humph. I suppose if we must abide the Warlock's decree, we might as well be about it then, the Duke said. Answer me two things first, however. What did you do to get this assignment?
I defeated a goblin army that had destroyed two other scouting expeditions already, and I outwitted Warlock Rashan at chess. He also seems to appreciate the fact that I do not back down from him when I think he is wrong, Brannis replied, trying to word his answers carefully. He could scarcely justify the Warlock's confidence in him. Brannis could only hope that 200-odd summers' worth of intuition knew what they were doing.
Fair enough, then. Second, what would become of me if I ordered you thrown in the dungeons while I conducted the coming battle my way?
Since by order of the Imperial Regent I am in charge here, I would have to do whatever was in my power to maintain my command. I would run you through myself and see if your elder son was more reasonable, and in the event you were successful in removing myself as well as my companions, Rashan would find another noble house to elevate to the Duchy of Rainsdark after he killed you, and likely your entire family. Your Grace, and I say this with due respect to all parties involved, Rashan Solaran is every bit the monster that history reports him as. He finds his position tenuous after discovering treason within the inner circle, and rectifying it in his own fashion by killing those he deemed to be most responsible. I find him to be utterly loyal to the Empire and the Imperial line. He is also frighteningly powerful, fiendishly intelligent, and surprisingly introspective and thoughtful. But above all, utterly and chillingly ruthless. If he feels you are working against him, he would find himself remiss if he did not kill you. The Kadrin Empire did not make enemies of half of Vaedris because of his tolerance and social graces. Duke Peloton paused for a moment before responding.
I come from a proud family and find that I enjoy the study of history. I am well familiar with the deeds of Rashan Solaran. There has been some debate,
the Duke looked meaningfully at Caldrax,
as to whether the reports that Warlock Rashan has returned are indeed true, or whether there is some sort of impostor at work.
Among the Inner Circle, there is no debate, Rugler commented. There is still a hole in the sanctum where Gravis Archon was killed.
Brannis noticed Juliana wince at the mention of her grandfather's recent demise. He had been careful not to bring the subject up, but Rugler was less concerned about tact. It reminded Brannis as well that his own father was killed in that same purging. He felt oddly detached from it, a fact that he could not muster a sense of shame for. Duke Peloton took his leave of them after that, giving them over to the custody of his younger son, Minon, with instructions to show them around the city. Minon had his father's build, but the stooping posture of one who cares little for commanding the respect of others. He seemed morose and aloof, though not as embittered as his father. As they exited the drawing room, Brannis caught sight of something. As she turned, Juliana's loose overtunic twirled slightly, and there was a glint of something beneath that Brannis was rather convinced was a dagger hilt. He hung back as the group moved into the corridor and fell into step behind Juliana. Brannis took her by the arm and slowed their pace. When they had fallen behind a bit, he reached in and pulled the dagger from its hiding place, drawing a small indignant gasp from Juliana, which Brannis cynically suspected was feigned. Fortunately, it had not attracted the attention of the rest of the group.
What is this? He whispered,
holding the dagger out in front of her in accusation. It was carved with runes whose purpose Brannis could at least guess at, if not identify.
Non-combatant. Understood? No getting involved once the fighting starts. Brannis, you brought me here. I am no aspiring warlock. I have no intention of seeking out battle. But if the fighting gets as far as me, I do not intend to go down in flames, hurling fire like some crazed goblin. Oh, and I had them there before we even left Cadrus. And it took you this long to notice them?
She plucked the dagger deftly from Brannis's hand as he was still wondering what them meant. She twirled the dagger through her fingers before stabbing it deftly back into its sheath.
Did they not teach you juggling at the academy?
We used little cloth balls filled with sand, and you know it, Brannis whispered back, trying to keep their little tiff from alerting the others. It was a rudimentary way that aspiring sorcerers learned to finally control their hand movements, and a great help in developing dexterity for spellcasting.
Well, my daggers are runed and deadly. I know how to use them, and I could juggle them better than you could ever juggle those little cloth balls,
Juliana countered, and she quickened her pace to rejoin the group. The Undercity was oppressive. After days spent in the autumn chill and the icy, biting cold of the mountains, the lower level of Rainsdark felt like summer. Not like the pleasant, sunny days of few clouds and balmy nights, but the humid, sticky heat that made breathing seem a chore. Whereas the Overcity was deserted, the Undercity teemed with activity. The foundries and forges gave off a reddish-orange light that tinted the entire space.
The noise from them pervaded the vast, domed space of the Undercity,
with iron on stone, iron on iron, and the hiss of steam forming an industrial symphony that was discordant to those who had not grown up around it.
All the heavy labor is ogrish now, Minon remarked as they watched a gang of ogres trudge by. We used to still have human labor for work in the diamond mines until a few summers ago, but we've trained them to the point where the ogres do that as well.
How do you keep them under control? Phelan asked.
Brannis knew the answer, but left it to Minon to explain.
These are all captive bred, Minon answered. Most of ours are sixth generation at least, and we have not had any wild born in my lifetime. None of them have so much as heard ogre spoken. We train them from childhood, so they do not know any other way.
Brannis had fought wild ogres, and the difference was stark. These tamed ogres were bigger and better fed, probably stronger as well, but they had a dull look in their eyes. They slaved away in the mines, and that was their entire life. The wild ones had their own culture and worshipped nature gods, painting their faces with colorful mud-like paints before battles to frighten the spirits of their enemies. Minon led them to the temporary campground that had been set up for the refugees from Illard's Glen. With no need for protection from the elements, it had sprung up as sort of an open-air barracks, with bedrolls littering the ground, and little or no real privacy to be had. Whatever belongings the refugees had managed to bring along with them were lying here and there all about, relying on the openness and a sense of community for security against theft. Brannis interviewed a number of the refugees, allowing Minon to take the rest of the group to see the markets and some of the other non-strategic parts of the Undercity. Brannis was able to tease out the details of the attack from a half dozen different witnesses, the most valuable of whom was a huntsman who had recovered from an apparent case of magical tampering and recalled seeing the goblin encampment before the battle. The siege weapons they described were most certainly cannons. It seemed that the goblins had been able to cast them out of bronze. There had been no other reports that indicated any earlier tests of the weapons, so it would seem that the goblins had done well enough in their first attempt to pulverize Illard's Glen's walls. The damage had been explained to him and seemed gratuitous. They were likely just working out their aim or performing drills. Brannis considered the forges and the ready supply of iron and wondered how long it would take to replicate the goblins' success. The resources were all at hand, he was fairly certain. Kyrus could easily find out the proper way to mix the black powder from the crew of the Harbinger or someone in Marker's Point, and he could study the design of the ship's guns. They could make iron versions in Rainsdark, heavier and stronger than the ones the goblins could make from bronze. If they could produce them in time, they could outgun the goblin army. It was a serious problem if the goblins were able to set up their cannons and pound the Rainsdark defenses with impunity from farther away than they could retaliate. As Brannis considered the cannons that the goblins had,
he considered how the goblins had learned of them. That Denric Zane was involved seemed nearly certain. He had admitted sharing that marvelous invention of warfare with Vaedris, and the goblins were probably better candidates for producing working black powder than the Magrin were. The Magrin were traders, merchants, and philosophers, as well as warriors, Brennus admitted, but not noted alchemists. If Denric had been in a hurry to get the cannons made, it would be easier to trade with the goblins, the plans in exchange for working copies, for instance, than to teach his own people.
If Denric had to teach the goblins how to make the cannons, could it be possible that he is the human liaison reportedly traveling with the goblin army? Brennus's eyes widened. Yes, that might even be likely. I shall have to try to find out through Kyrus.
The tour of the Undercity had been enlightening, but Brennus hoped that it would have little bearing on the city's defense in the expected battle. If they were driven back to defending the Undercity, they might be in serious trouble. The Overcity and the walls were what concerned Brennus most. Minon took them for a walk on those very walls, fitted stone battlements 4 times the height of a man, constructed in the same manner as the castle, and just as old. Leaning over, Brennus could see runes in a long, unbroken line along the length of the wall. Iridan, I want you to get started tomorrow on shoring up these runes, Brennus ordered. As much power as you can manage. Get them near to bursting if you can, and make sure there are no weak spots. Thanks, Brennus. I get appointed to the inner circle, and not a 10-day goes by before you demote me back to ward keeper, Iridan joked. Prior to joining Brennus' expedition to Kelvi Forest, Wardkeeper had been Iridan's occupation. There were a group of a dozen or so at any given time in the city of Cadran, keeping up civic wards on wells, sewers, roads, and anything else that required ether to function or last. They would recarve or replace damaged runes and supply ether to depleted ones. Usually, new wards were carved by more senior sorcerers for official imperial use. But all the ward keepers knew the craft well enough, and many did work on the side to earn extra money, earning hefty commissions from paranoid merchants and nobles. Phelan, can you create an illusion of a half wall? Brennus asked. To what end? The sorcerer said. I expect this wall to be destroyed in the early goings of the battle. We are going to have to fight within the city itself, and I want to funnel the goblins into a few areas to make them easier to contain. If they approach the wall and find sections that are not completely destroyed, they will avoid them, and it will make them more predictable, Brennus said. Why not just make the wall appear whole? Phelan questioned. We want them to believe what they see, or at least not question it over much. If they attack the wall and never see any damage, they are going to figure it out and counter it. We need a light touch and some realistically damaged-looking walls to fool them. Now, Rugler, I want you to rune arrows with magic to carry them farther. On some of them include runes that will get them through simple shielding constructs, Brennus continued. Will that not foul the aim of the archers? Minon asked, listening in on a conversation that only tangentially involved him. He held no rank in the Rainsdark army and would be tucked safely underground when the fighting started. It may, Brennus said. But the goblins will set up siege engines out of the range of the archers, and it will be our only chance to strike at them. I expect that once arrows start reaching them, the sorcerers will use shielding magics, and then the archers can switch to the arrows with the extra runes. I see no need to rune them all. Take the time to make more with the distance runes. Brennus had been giving this thought since he heard about the cannons, and was finally getting the chance to lay his plan out before his politely skeptical sorcerers. The arrows ought to reach the goblins without magic, Minon added, and Brennus wondered if the fellow knew something of use after all. Our bowmen are quite skilled, and we have them equipped with excellent bows. The new weapons of theirs will outdistance the bowmen, Brennus said flatly. He was hoping that he would not have to.
How can you know that? Juliana asked.
Explain how he knew that. The refugees' estimates of the placement of the weapons when they were fired. It would seem that extended range is a primary advantage of the goblins' latest weapons, Brennus lied, Well, the statement is probably accurate, but none of the refugees offered anything that's specifically useful. I cannot exactly tell them. I have seen them in action, and trust me, long range on those things.
What of Caldrax? Should we assign him some tasks as well for the preparations? Iridan asked.
I am putting you in charge of him. Have him help with the wards on the walls. How long those last may play a key part in the battle, Brannis said.
I can only hope they do not have enough cannonballs to bring down the whole wall. I do not like the thought of laying under siege for long enough for them to finish.
I did not get the feeling that he was terribly impressed with me. Why would he take orders from me? Iridan asked.
You seem to forget. You are inner circle now. Even if he is not officially in the Imperial Circle, he would have difficulty justifying any defiance of your orders. If these folk here are not terrified of crossing our new regent, they ought to be, Brannis said.
It's getting late. We ought to head to the castle for dinner, Minon suggested.
Indeed, I shall clarify anything that needs clarifying come morning. We have been long on the road, though walking about all afternoon has felt better than sitting a horse. Lead on, Minon.
Brannis waited for everyone to start, and then began counting down in his head. 3, 2, 1.
What about me? Juliana demanded,
getting in Brannis's path to block the way to food, wine, and respite until she had been heard.
Oh, just get to know the locals. I will have you in charge of keeping them safe during the battle, Brannis said in a raised voice.
He pulled Juliana close as he started toward the castle after the rest. I have a different plan for you, he continued in a much lower voice, barely above a whisper. I want you to weaken the avalanche wards that keep the Neverthaw Glacier from dropping a mountainside of snow over the city. If things go badly, we are going to bury the city under snow and seek the aid of the Stone Folk. Rainstark's deepest mines cross their territories, and we do not mind them anymore. They would not fight for our sake.
But we could probably buy passage through their caverns
for our civilians.
Would that not destroy the whole city? Juliana asked, incredulous, slowing them a step further behind everyone else, lest her voice carry.
No, the buildings are warded against avalanche as well, though the wards are older. I have been studying magic to make better use of it in warfare, and I was able to recognize the runes as we walked through the city. The avalanche wards on the retaining wall on the cliffs above the city, I read about in the army's reports of the city's defenses.
So this was your plan all along? No wonder you played coy, Juliana observed.
No, it was just my reserve plan, in case things go badly. Do you think you can manage it? Use that rune dagger you are so proud of and cross some things out?
I can.
Good. Let us catch up before we are missed.
House Peloton's dinners appeared to be rather formal affairs, though thankfully less unwelcoming due to the womenfolk attending. Duke Peloton may have been the epitome of the denigrating nobleman, but the Duchess Delea Peloton was a charming woman. Of middling summers, with only streaks of white through her light brown hair to betray her age, she looked every bit the young maid her eldest daughter did. Fina Peloton was the image of her mother, with a tiny upturned nose, high round cheeks, and a curved figure. Minon attended with his lady wife Ayla, a plump, cheerful woman who talked almost constantly. The heads of Duke Peloton's garrisoned forces attended along with their wives as well, and seemed far more open and personable than their master. The Duke's elder son Harwell did not attend, possibly meaning it as a personal objection to the newcomers supplanting his father's authority. His lady attended in his place. Gedandra Peloton was slight of frame and short of womanly charms as well. She slouched like Minon at the table and had the look of a young lad in the face and the build of one in the body. She was born to the house of Rolik in Naran Port, and the marriage was strictly of convenience. In their brief introduction, Brannis had found her to be quick of wit, which made her instantly more interesting to him than the vapid girl the sorcerer had brought. Caldrax's lady, who was not introduced as his wife, was a pale, curvy creature
with shadowed eyes that rarely lifted to meet the eye of anyone who spoke with her, and who spoke little, which was thankful, as on those occasions that prompted her to speak, she rarely improved upon her standing among those present. The Duke's younger daughters attended as well. Demne and Phalia were twins, yet not of age to wed as sorcerers would judge it, but the nobles tended to err on the side of marrying their daughters too young. They dressed identically in low-cut, corseted pink dresses, with many-layered petticoats fluffing them out. Brannis was unsure whose idea the dresses were, but he found them to be in poor taste. He had been raised by sorcerers, even if he was not one himself, and found nobles' marriage and daughter-peddling practices to be tawdry. Of course, he was unable to cast blame too far, lest he catch one of his own in the net. While Brannis wore his quicksilver breastplate over mail, and Iridan, Phaelin, and Ruglor wore their formal Imperial Circle garb, which in Iridan's case was quite impressive, Juliana had taken a different tact. While adhering to the traditional black of the circle, she wore a strapless gown of scandalously thin material, making the Duke's daughters seem prudish by comparison. She cinched it at the waist with a blood-red sash and had a red silk shawl to match, to keep the slight chill of the Overcity half of the castle at bay. Brannis wished very much that he had ether vision at that point, as he was very curious how the dress kept itself in place, and whether there was magic enhancing her figure, or whether he had really just not realized. Brannis managed to keep his attention focused on the conversation as the meal went on. He was seated at the far end of the long table from the Duke, with Juliana just on the far side of Iridan from him. He thought he did well to keep his eyes to his food, or to whomever he was speaking, but knew that he was not entirely successful. He knew, for instance, that Juliana had left that dagger, or daggers, of hers in her room.
"Sir Brannis,"
Duke Peloton stood and raised a goblet of the spiced wine they were drinking.
"May the follies of youth plague not your endeavors, and may all of us live to see their fruit."
The others at the table raised their goblets as well, as much out of habit and reflex as out of sympathy for the sentiments offered. Brannis raised his as well, but did not drink. Instead, he stood and offered a toast of his own. "And to Duke Peloton, may he extend the warmth of his hospitality to our goblin foes as well, that they might freeze to death and save us the trouble of killing them." That drew a chuckle from the table, and a wary look from the Duke. "Your Grace, if the goblins do not attack us, or if your troops turn them aside so easily that no help of ours was needed, I will gladly bear whatever ridicule you wish to heap upon me," Brannis said while still standing, as was Duke Peloton, at the far end of the table. "And if at that point you wish to voice your displeasure to the regent, Warlock Roshan, I suspect you might find me relieved of my rank, if not my life. And upon my death, if you wish to toast your foresight and laugh over my grave, I will offer no resistance. But until such time as we have either defeated the goblins, or I am convinced that they have turned their intentions elsewhere, I expect the full cooperation of the forces of Rainsdark and their commanders. That includes yourself, Your Grace. Sometime in the next handful of days, there will be a goblin army at the foot of your mountain, and I have been ordered by the acknowledged ruler of the Empire to defend it. I will do so with or without your help, though I would be obliged for any aid that is available in my charged duty."
"Well spoken, boy. I appreciate blunt words. You will have my cooperation, if not my approval. That you may only have if you are both correct and victorious," Duke Peloton said.
Brannis did not know if the presence of the Duchess softened the Duke's mood or tempered his words, but he suspected that the fact Duke Peloton had no grounds to defy him without risking the ire of Roshan played a part somewhere.
Humility was a dish best served to someone else,
yet Duke Peloton had at least lifted a spoonful of it to sniff it experimentally. The remainder of the meal passed without further incident. Brannis spoke mainly to his own companions, and made a bit of light conversation with the commanders of Rainsdark's forces and their wives. The house Peloton end of the table was quieter, and kept their conversation amongst themselves as well. The day's events had worn Brannis down,
and he retired to his borrowed chambers gladly. It felt wonderful to slip into the bath that one of the servants had drawn for him. The ruined armor was by far the most comfortable protection he had ever worn, but it was still mail beneath the plates, and hot, sweaty padding below that. Never one for soaking, he washed himself and prepared for a well-earned slumber in a proper bed. After drying off from the bath, he checked that the books he had brought from the Tower Library were still in good order. He had little time to read them while on the road, though he had perused a bit before bed. This night, though, he found that he was more interested in the soft blankets than yellowed old tomes, and put them away once he had seen to their safety.
Sorry, Kyrus. Tomorrow, I promise.
It was chilly in the room, and when the residual warmth from the bath fully left him, it grew unpleasant. The glassed window at the front of the room let in enough light to find the bed with lanterns out, and lacking magic, he preferred to keep the heavy green curtains wide open. Thankful for the thick carpets on his bare feet, he climbed into the bed. Brannis closed his eyes and headed off to see what was going on with the crew of the Harbinger. In the darkened hallway of Rainsdark Castle, a figure clung to the shadows. With thick carpets quieting careful feet, the figure felt its way along. It found its objective at the end of the corridor, the last of the rooms in the guests' wing, usually reserved for visiting nobility. The figure examined the door carefully, running a thin-fingered hand over the wood, searching with a practiced hand. It could find no wire or catch to trigger a trap, nor any ward to interfere with its entry, for it knew the ways of ether and was careful of such things. The same thin hand tried the door and found it opened easily and quietly. It was not even locked. It was almost too easy. The slight figure slipped inside and oh so quietly closed the door. The floor in the guest room was well covered in rugs as well, and there was no sound as the figure approached the sleeping knight. The chest rose and fell slowly, rhythmically, almost hypnotically. The pale moonlight from the window was even enough to make out the beating of the heart in the knight's neck. Slowly, the figure leaned in closer to the knight, holding its breath lest the knight sense the approach by a disturbance in the air. With dexterity and practiced control, the figure got right down next to the knight's neck and laid a gentle kiss just above the collarbone. Using the distraction of the kiss and the tickle of hair that fell on Brannis as he stirred in his sleep, Juliana eased herself up onto the bed and beneath the blankets. She had noticed on the journey to Rainsdark just how heavily Brannis slept and was taking full advantage. She ran a hand up Brannis's chest and reached her leg across him, slowly drawing herself atop him, straddling his waist. Of course, there were limits to the things even as sound a sleeper as Brannis could slumber through, and some laggardly watchman within his sleeping thoughts saw fit to inform Brannis that something important is going on. Brannis woke confused, briefly wondering if he had bedded one of the serving girls from dinner. The smell of honeysuckle brought back a wash of memories and cleared up any doubts as to who his bedmate was. She hung her smiling face above his, her unbound hair streaming down around the both of them, creating a curtained area for just herself and Brannis.
"Tonight is ours, Brannis," she whispered, and then ran a hand down along his bicep.
"What are you doing here?" Brannis asked softly. He had not seen that particular smile from her in a long time, and his thoughts began to form small puddles at the bottom of his brain as they melted away. She wore the dress from dinner, but without the sash or shawl to go along with it, or even shoes, as he could feel her cold, bare feet against his legs. Other than her feet, the rest of her felt warm and inviting, the thin fabric of the dress doing nothing to shield him from the warmth of her body.
"We may never get this chance again. Tomorrow we all may die, or be swept up in battle and events carry us away. I do not know. All I need to know is I have you now, for tonight at least," she whispered.
She leaned down and pressed her lips to his. He returned her kiss, but hesitated.
Brannis shook his head. I cannot do this. You are betrothed to my best friend.
And I still will be come morning.
That is not the point, Brannis said.
But it is, Juliana said. It is not Iridan that I came to be with tonight. I want you.
I cannot have you. Brannis barely managed to get the words out. It was the hardest thing he had ever admitted. She balled up her fist and pounded it on his chest.
Why?
She protested, hitting him again.
Why could you not have been a sorcerer like you were supposed to be? Did your mother bed one of the stable hands? You were supposed to be mine.
She pulled back and seemed about to really slam her fist down, but Brannis caught it this time. But I am not. Iridan is going to be yours now. He is a good man and a good friend, Brannis replied calmly.
Brannis, you are more a man at 14 than I suspect Iridan will ever be.
She seemed about to cry, her breath coming in short gasps between sniffles. With one wrist in Brannis's grasp, she held down his other arm and leaned in to kiss him again, making one last desperate attempt to overwhelm his reason with her anything but reason. But Brannis ignored her grasp and let go of her other wrist. He took her gently but firmly by the midsection and lifted her up. Held aloft by her center of balance, Juliana could do little to struggle loose as Brannis sat up and plopped her down in a seated position, still kneeling astride him. Brannis wrapped his arms around Juliana and pulled her close. She curled up in his arms and began to sob. Brannis said nothing, and Juliana was beyond words, just feeling the strength of his arms holding her and letting loose feelings that had been building to a boil for far too long. When at last she had run dry of tears, Juliana was able to compose herself enough to leave Brannis's bed. She kissed him quickly on the forehead, not trusting herself to try anything more, and quickly disappeared down the corridor to return to her own room. When she was gone, Brannis got out of bed and found his sword. Drawing Avalanche from its sheath, he walked over to the door and pressed the blade flat against the wood, closest to the handle side and oriented up and down. He released his grip and the sword remained in place, held by rune-forged magic and certain to keep out any further intruders, no matter how welcome their intentions might be. Having secured the door, Brannis went to stand by the window. The glass let in a chill that felt cleansing, and Brannis thought he could use some about then. He looked at the night view of the abandoned Overcity and wondered how soon the attack would come. He watched the view long enough for his passions to cool and for the warmth of Juliana's body to escape him. As he climbed back into bed, he noticed that it had managed to acquire a faint whiff of honeysuckle.
I am a fool, perhaps a good man, perhaps a good friend, but definitely a fool.